This is Jim Inkster. We're 5 days away from the November 4th election, and today we'll talk with the candidate that Mary Landrieu defeated in a runoff in 2002, Suzanne Hike-Terrell, former New Orleans council person, and she has some thoughts about what's going on with Mary Landrieu, Bill Cassidy, and Rob Manus. Last night was the final debate before the election. Also, Leo Honeycutt, the biographer of Edwin Edwards, is back with another compelling story about a Louisiana business titan and his thoughts about Edwin Edwards running for Congress. And we'll hear from Steve Myers, a Baton Rouge realtor, on what he views as uneven assessments of property values in Baton Rouge. What's going on? Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to WRKF 89.3, and Leo Honeycutt is our first guest on his birthday, October 30th, 1955. That makes Leo 59 years old today.
Wow, way back the half of the last century.
And he is a man who's had a full life in his nearly six decades on the planet. So
it's great when you put it like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, you actually start your sixth decade when you turn a nine.
Oh, yeah. Is that what happens?
Yeah.
Okay, so the odometer has already rolled over, and yeah. I don't know it.
You are now in your 60th year, though you turned 59 today.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate that.
But you look great, and Leo's been busy the last several months polishing up his latest biography on the heels of some successful work, including the definitive work on Edwin Washington Edwards, who we'll talk about in a moment, and Jerry Lane, and now?
And now, Clark Williams.
Clark Williams.
Now, only about 1 out of 10 people in Louisiana have ever even heard of Century Telephone. But it happens to be America's third largest telecom, right behind AT&T and Verizon. And one of the miracles is that it's still based in Louisiana. 47,000 employees, $20 billion company, Fortune 200, Louisiana's top private employer. But it all came from 75 customers of Oak Ridge Telephone, which is a community in North Louisiana about the size of this office.
And it started with a hope and a prayer, literally, and in the middle of nowhere. So how did it become this communications juggernaut?
Well, Clark Williams was quite a different kind of businessman. I mean, it was when he was coming up, it just happened to hit just right after World War II when a lot of the mom-and-pop operations began to sell off. Of course, AT&T, Bell Telephone, had all the cities because of the density. They already had those locked in, but they didn't want the rural areas. Then REA came out in the 1940s, a government program to make sure that everybody out in the hinterland had access. And so that's why you had all these mom-and-pop operations. Clark Williams comes along and says, well, you know, if I'm going to try to make one fly, I may as well try to make two fly and three and four. And eventually what he found was is that with every acquisition, he always insisted on keeping all the employees employed with every acquisition. So that meant he had to go out and get another to keep the cash flow going. So he spent many, many years, if in fact not decades, probably near bankruptcy. But there was one great thing that happened that he could not foresee, mm-hmm. and that was all these insignificant rural area community exchanges became infinitely valuable with the advent of cellular. So when cellular came in the early 80s, his vast network, especially all the areas along interstates, became extremely valuable, and it just went up exponentially.
Well, William Clark and Marie Williams purchased the then Oak Ridge Telephone Company for $500 in 1930.
Just as the Depression started.
$500.
Isn't that a great time to get into a business?
Yeah, and in 1946, Clark Williams marries Mary Catherine Lee after returning from World War II, and his parents gave the company to the couple as a wedding gift.
Well, gave is a relative term. This truly was an albatross. Oak Ridge Telephone had never really turned a profit, and it was a jumble of wires that were tacked literally to barns and trees and fence posts. And every time a wind came up, they had to go out with fishing poles. You remember those cane fishing poles to untwist the line so that people could call.
Well, this is a book that I think warrants attention for anybody in Louisiana, and this is a huge, huge company. I saw the other day they changed PR firms, and as a result, the biggest PR firm in Louisiana reduced its workforce by about 20% because they lost the contract. Hmm. So, big money, and Clark Williams was the man who made the company move into the stratosphere.
Yes, he is, and he and his son both actually did that. It's funny because when he got into the telephone business in a big way, the technology was changing from the operator having to call up the operator and say, "Hey, Susan, can you connect me to Jim and just simply plug it in a wire to dial-up?" And part of the reason why they wanted to go to dial-up was because it meant privacy. There was virtually no privacy on telephones until dial-up in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. So Clark Sr.
Did you ever have a party line, Leo?
Oh, yeah.
I did, too.
You did?
Yeah.
My grandmother was on one with eight people on it. Eight people, and they all loved to listen. Yes, I remember it well.
1973, shares of Century Common Stock were traded on the New York Stock Exchange for the first time under the symbol CTL. October 24, 1973 was the date. And
actually, it was 78, but
it's
okay.
It was 73. That's
that's the company. You know, you can't trust that. No, really.
It was 78?
No, it was. They actually went over the counter in 68, and then 78, they went on the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay, so that's 35 years ago.
Yeah.
And a whole lot's happened since then.
Mm-hmm.
35 years and 6 days. And in 19, if I have my date right, 1989, Century paid $90 million in cash for Universal Telephone. So sometime between the acquisition in 1946 as a wedding gift in 1989, a whole lot happened.
A whole lot happened.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the last acquisitions they made was Ma Bell West. They got one of the Baby Bells and acquired the Pacific Telecom and Quest out in Denver. Mm-hmm. And so now they have this huge territory all the way up to Washington State. Of course, in fact, the Seattle Seahawks, the stadium is CenturyLink Stadium.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a huge company, and like Delta Airlines, it started not far from where you were born 59 years ago.
That's right, in Monroe.
On this date. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it is. It is incredible. It's incredible. You should see the headquarters up there. It's a pretty phenomenal thing. But it all goes back to a basic principle that Clark Williams believed in, and that was he ran his life like he ran his company like he ran his life, which was by the golden rule: treat others as you would like to be treated. In fact, in every acquisition he made, and I had so many people that told me this verbatim, they said that whenever he was talking to sellers, potential sellers, he would say, "Look, if this is not a good deal for you, I don't want to do it."
Mm-hmm. You're unveiling the book at the Book Festival.
Saturday.
Saturday. What time?
Well, we have a presentation in House Committee Room 2 at 10 a.m.
At 10 a.m., and Leo will unveil this book, The Biography of Clark Williams. How difficult was it to derive information for this?
Pretty difficult, because this was a guy that played a lot under the radar. He shunned publicity. It's not because he was hiding anything. It's because he really was a very shy man. He didn't want to boast. He really was not big on trying to flaunt what he had done. And in fact, like I said before, he was near bankruptcy for half of his life. But the thing that he did discover that I found through the research was, he found that if he prayed and kept prayer as a part of his routine business acumen, that he always succeeded. And one thing he found, too, he was a scholar, a Bible scholar. He went through Scripture for his entire life, and he studied it intensely. And one thing he found was that the vast majority of people say they read the Bible when, in fact, they don't. And it inadvertently gave him a competitive advantage, because through reading the Bible, he could almost predict the future, because he knew what human nature was and what would be an outcome from almost any scenario.
Mm-hmm. I remember I had George Kennedy, one of my favorite political consultants, the guy who's representing Jay Darden on this show, and a caller questioned him about the Bible and quoted the Book of Romans, and George says, "I'm a New Testament kind of guy."
Well,
you got the joke, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think it was a joke. I think George just pretended he knew about the book of Romans, and obviously he did not. 297-5633. As we segue into politics, and remember 10 o'clock, committee room 2 in the House side.
Saturday morning. It's going to be great. Festival. Bring your coat, too. It's supposed to be in the 30s.
Really?
Yeah. Saturday morning is supposed to be like 39.
Good. Today, front page of the New York Times, colorful rogues make way for national issues, and it's about Louisiana. And it discusses, in a story by Campbell Robertson and Jonathan Martin, a festival in New Roads where Senator Landrieu and Bill Cassidy were largely ignored, but the star of the show?
Edwin Edwards.
He still lights up a room, doesn't he?
He still does. You know, we've been to all these different debates. I mean, we went to two last week. You know, you were one of the panelists last week asking the questions. And I got to tell you, I like everybody involved. I really do. But Edwin Edwards just thinks on his feet, whereas a lot of the other candidates, I'm sorry, just sound like they're canned messages. And you and I have lived long enough to know that we've seen so many of the candidates that are like this that don't seem to really have that much of a vision. Their deal is to either be against somebody or to lash out at somebody else, and then we're supposed to take the negative and then vote for that negative. And you know, it's just, when you get to this age, it's like we've already heard all this stuff before, and invariably, the guys who go in with the canned messages, we don't hear from until the next election.
Well, Bob Mann has called Edwin Edwards a farce to be reckoned with.
Well, Bob's entitled to his opinion.
Well, Bob's a John Bro guy, and John Bro and Edwin Edwards, for whatever reason, have not seen eye to eye, even though Edwin Edwards is the man who made John Bro. Mm-hmm. What went on? What happened between those two?
I have no idea. All I know is that John Bro never contacted him while he was in prison, and I think that hurt his feelings.
Well, I would understand that hurting his feelings. Did he try to help him when he was seeking a pardon?
Now, I did hear something about that. And I believe he did. I want to believe that he did anyway. So I don't know. I don't really know who went to George Bush Sr. and Jr., but apparently, aside from Dave Treen, but apparently there was a number of people.
Well, today's story on Louisiana, front page story in the New York Times, says, quoting a gentleman, Gregory Mouton, saying that the son of an accordion maker said he was open to politicians of any party, but he was against anyone who was supportive of the Obama agenda, as Ms. Landrieu appeared to be, asked whether a politician like John Bro could win this year on his kind of platform. Mouton paused and then said, "I don't know John Bro. I've heard the name."
So
how soon we forget. He hasn't been around for a decade now.
Well, let's face it, too, and this is one thing that really bothers me about our system in general. It seems that we have turned Congress into an incubator for lobbyists. They go in, they spend two terms, three terms maybe, and then suddenly they get these million-dollar jobs working the room for paid interest. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I can guarantee you that Edwin Edwards won't do.
No, but Democrats and Republicans have cashed in after leaving Congress and are doing business with the people they associated with and making a lot more doing that than they did as lawmakers. Next Tuesday, I would predict Edwards would receive, I'm just saying, he'll run first in the primary, be an underdog in the runoff, no matter who he's against, but I say 35%. What do you think?
I think that's probably fair. In fact, to be honest with you, I didn't give him a snowball's chance when he first started. I asked him, why? You're 3 years away from 90. Why do you want to run? Why do you want to do this? Well, it's, what else have I got to do? You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And now, since I've been with him a little bit, I'm not in the campaign, but on the periphery, just kind of watching all this come together, again, he seems to, I hear people all the time say he seems to make more sense than anybody else.
Well, he's the only one who is speaking without a script. He has.
Well, you get that feeling.
That's true. And I think last night at the debate, the two major candidates, Mary Landrieu and Bill Cassidy, they were essentially on script. And they didn't make any big mistakes. And some say because there was no gaffe from Congressman Cassidy, that puts him in the driver's seat. We'll talk about this more with Susie Terrell, the candidate Mary Landrieu defeated in 2002. Thank you, Leo. See you Saturday.
All right.
Happy birthday.
And congratulations to you.
Thank you. We'll be back. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Susie Terrell, who was elections commissioner, elected statewide, and was a council person of note in New Orleans. And in 2002, she ran for the U.S. Senate and defeated two other strong Republicans in that race, and John Cooksey and Tony Perkins, and got in a runoff with Mary Landrieu, a very close runoff. And it's the only time Mary Landrieu has been forced into a December election. And so there are some parallels between then and now, the major one being the fact that it is a December election. But the biggest distinction is that in 2002, Senator Landrieu was running with a Republican president in office. This time, she's running with a Democrat who is unpopular in Louisiana. And as we heard last night at the debate, Bill Cassidy called it the Obama-Landrieu economy. He is trying to tie the president and the senior senator as closely together as possible. Susie Terrell, good morning to you.
Good morning. I was going to jump right in because I was going to say there are a lot of parallels that I've read that, I've seen a lot, and I think you pick up some of the parallels, especially the national press doesn't see the parallels because we did go into a December election, but in November, December was also the fight for the control of the Senate, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats were in control in 2002, and the Republicans were going to fight for control. And this, I think, played some into our race, in that Republicans got control in November. So there was a lot of national spotlight because it was the only race in the country, but there wasn't as much of an urgency to get that. It would have been the 52nd seat. In retrospect, that should have put everything they could have to get the 52nd seat because they lost the Senate, two or four years later, you know. So there's that parallel. What happens in November is going to have an effect on what happens in December relative to money, forces of people that will come in from both sides, senators that are elected or campaigning. You know, Mary has not brought in any heavy hitters. She'll never bring in Obama, but I think there's some people who are a little more popular in Louisiana that are Democrats. I mean, she did bring in Bill Clinton, but, you know, I would think that Hillary could do a little bit in New Orleans, but in the southern part of the state. You know, I think there's some people that we could bring in. All of that being said, like ours in 2002, the whole race is going to come down to turnout.
Well, Hillary Clinton will be in New Orleans Saturday, and Congressman Cassidy will be campaigning with Ben Carson, so same day.
Got it. Well, there you go.
this is almost certainly the dress rehearsal. The big race will be December the 6th. Yours was December 7th, 2002. Mm-hmm. And in that race, Mary Landrieu received 638,654 votes. And the lady we're talking with, Suzanne Hike-Terrell, received 596,642 votes. So a difference of 42,000 in a few votes. And it was a tight race.
You know, I'll tell you, Jim, what is, I always think the unknown is, I will never forget that election night, Fox News called the race for us, and we were in our room, and I, you know, our little holding room, and I called, what parishes are in? And they said, Lafayette and New Orleans. And I said, well, we've lost. Even though we were leading, I said, we lost. And, you know, all these people from Washington are saying, you couldn't have lost us. Yeah, we lost. So Louis Perrette, who's the clerk of court in Lafayette, called in his numbers. And when we added them up, I said, we've lost. We don't have enough votes to beat what's going to come out of Orleans Parish.
Well, there you go.
We had won the state. Okay, we were leading. We had been called the winner, and then Orleans Parish came and it flipped those 80,000 votes that made that 42,000 mm-hmm. vote difference.
Yes, yeah, she won. Mary Landrieu did by almost 80,000 in New Orleans, Orleans Parish. And you mm-hmm. you lost by 42,000 statewide.
Right. So we were leading the state.
By 38,000, yeah. But
right. We were leading her going into Orleans. So I'm just saying that, and I've said this all along, is it's going to be a turnout race. It's going to be who can turn out their voters. And I know there's been a lot of talk about how New Orleans has changed, you know, post-Katrina. And that's true, but New Orleans population is up. A lot of the people that have moved to New Orleans are, you know, the people that have come to save New Orleans who would tend to be a Landrieu voter, who know no one but Landrieu's as the mayor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There are people that might have good feelings about a Landrieu. I think that the bad feelings about Obama are going to win out. I think the bad feelings about what's going on in Washington is going to win out. I think in the end that Cassidy will win, but I'm just saying that, you know, it's not a slam dunk. They have to be, you know, work with precision.
It should be a close race. 297-5633. Either way, 297-5633 locally and outside the area, 877-217-5757. Now, does it surprise you that in that 2002 election that Bill Cassidy supported Mary Landrieu rather than you?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. There are a lot of people that did, and I don't hold grudges. I got over the grudges in about 2007.
So it took five years. Wow.
But you know, I do remember having an event in Baton Rouge at the Lott Cook Center, and Bill and Laura Cassidy were there for me. So I can only assume that Bill made a contribution to my campaign, and I've known Bill and Laura since sometime in the 80s, and, you know, that's all I can say. I mean, we, you know, in politics, there's always that kind of stuff. I mean, Boise Bollinger is supporting Mary Landrieu, you know, all the, my former finance chair, he was Cooksey's finance chairman. My former finance chairman is supporting Mary Landrieu. So, you know, you never know what's mm-hmm. saying, what ox to gourd, is that what it is?
Yeah.
You know, I think that, as my husband reminds me when I get angry about things, you know, that there are a lot of people that aren't doing what they do just out of their straight up, you know, their straight up, I guess you'd say, beliefs or values. You know, fortunately for me and unfortunately for me, I've always been somebody that does what I believe in, not what's, you know, necessarily politically expedient. I guess that's why I'm practicing law instead of, you know, drawing a state pension somewhere.
Now, you are a lawyer and a skilled debater, and you, unlike Congressman Cassidy, you were eager to debate Senator Landrieu, and she's not bad herself, and there was a memorable debate on Meet the Press. What happened when you and Senator Landrieu squared off with Tim Russert asking the questions?
It was, I will tell you, it was a tremendous experience, especially now that Russert is no longer with us, and I've had such a problem filling that void. It was, you know, the first question out of the box to me was about Mike Foster and how Mike Foster had said that he didn't care about which one of the, you know, bleep women won or something like that. It was, you know, and how do I respond to that, you know? And her first question was a similarly, you know, difficult question. But what I do remember is Nancy Pelosi was on the show that day. So I unfortunately have a picture of Nancy Pelosi and Tim Russert, Mary Landrieu, and me hanging in my office. So I guess I get to see that every day.
Well, those are four luminaries from the political world, including you.
But I don't know. Nancy Pelosi in the office. That's really...
Nancy's she's an impressive person, depending on where you come from.
And she looks the same.
Yeah, she does, and she's had some very good cosmetic surgery. She's a beautiful woman. Beautiful woman. East Baton Rouge Parish, that's a question. Where did the votes go in East Baton Rouge? And I'm looking in 2002, and I'd forgotten this, but Landrieu actually won East Baton Rouge Parish closely, but it was 63,418 for Landrieu and 61,229 for Terrell. People think this is a conservative bastion, but remember East Baton Rouge also went for President Obama a couple of years ago. So,
I will tell you, Jim, it took, and I think anybody who has experienced, the guys that experience a big loss in a football game or, last night's World Series, for a while, you don't want to look at things, right? You don't want to go read those numbers. But when I did look at those numbers, I realized there were places that were closer than they should have been. And there was also some drop-off in, central Louisiana around Alexandria. There had been, there was a hotly contested, if you'll remember, congressional race up there that got very, very, very nasty, even nastier than our race. I remember that Pat Bergeron and I think Roy Fletcher were looking at the numbers after, and they said that there was a drop-off in Republican voters going to the polls, and that in Central. So that's why I say it's always a turnout question in the end. No matter what the polls say, it's who actually shows up that day to vote.
Lafayette went heavily for Terrell in 2002, 30,000 to 21,000, and St. Tammany, which is probably the most conservative parish in the state. Let's see how that one went in 2002.
Jefferson and St. Tammany didn't go as high as they should have.
All right, 42,000 for you and 20,000 for Landrieu. So 22, you more than doubled her there.
But Jefferson was not, and I think part of what happened in Jefferson at that time, the president of Jefferson Parish, Tim Coulon, endorsed Mary Landrieu. And while people say they don't look at endorsements, when they don't know the candidates or they're torn, they're going to look to the endorsements.
Okay, Jefferson, you are correct. Now, but you still won there by 14,000 votes, 70,000 to 56, but that is considered to be a Republican stronghold. And
right, if we had doubled her there, like we did in St. Tammany, everything would be different.
Well, yeah, it was a close race, no doubt. Mary downtown. Mary, you're on with Susie Terrell. Good morning.
Good morning. I do have a question. We're talking about the three leading candidates in the race, but there are other candidates in this race that we know nothing about. And I am surprised that no one is talking about that they have not even been recognized. Perhaps they don't have enough money to run $1 million campaign but there are other alternatives to these three so-called leading candidates. And then we talk about, if we don't like Obama, then we should vote for Cassidy. But with all the problems that everybody is talking about that take place in Washington, why would we vote against somebody who's already in office for somebody who's trying to be in office and isn't telling us anything about what he's going to do when he gets there? I have a really hard time with all of this. And as a voter, it makes it very difficult for me because I'd like to be educated about everything that's going on in these elections now because it is so critical.
All right. And she makes a very good point. There are several candidates, and in fact, there is an African-American female Democrat, Val Senegal, I think from Opelousas, who is running. who, if she had resources, she could be as much of a thorn in Landrieu's side as Maness is in Cassidy's. But it comes down to money, and that's unfortunate, but that's a fact. And if you don't,
that's why incumbents have a tremendous, tremendous leg up, because an incumbent can raise money while they're in office. A challenger like the one she's speaking of don't have a way to raise money. They can self-fund, but, you know, who can self-fund? That's a lot of money to self-fund a campaign.
Cy on Perkins. Good morning, my friend. Cy, you're on with Susie Terrell.
Well, I wanted to take the opportunity to say hello to Susie Terrell, who I supported, and she's a dear friend of mine, though I haven't seen her in, 10,000 years. But, Susie, I'm glad you're doing well.
I recognize that voice.
I'm glad you're doing well, Susie, and I'm glad you're holding up well to the moderator, who obviously is Paul Landrieu. No question about that.
Now, why would you say that?
Well, because you're snarky about all of the things involving Cassidy, and you keep bringing up the fact that he did this or he did that. But anyway, Cassidy's going to win. But, Susie, I'm glad you're doing well and you're practicing law.
All right.
I wish
Thank
you good
you.
Luck.
Thank you, Cyrus Greco.
If you need me, Cyrus, I'm at Hangardner, Rodberg, and Terrell. So give me a call.
Yeah, well, the race in 2002, I think it was a fascinating race because you had two people. Born a year apart from New Orleans, females, and this is 12 years ago, and Louisiana showed some progress. And in the primary, between the two of you, in a race that included Tony Perkins and John Cooksey, you got 73% of the votes between you. So New Orleans, when you and I were growing up there, it was a death knell to be from New Orleans and run statewide, but now... It's not that anymore.
Well, Mitch Landrieu won statewide. You've got John Young.
And all the people in office now, including Jindal, who was elected from the New Orleans area as a representative congressman from Kenner.
Right.
Kennedy, Strain, yep. Mike Strain. It's now a benefit to be from New Orleans, but the question will come...
I don't know if it's a benefit. I think that the rest of the state accepts that geography better. How's that?
Okay.
I don't know that, I knew when I was growing up, it was sort of like there was New Orleans and then there was the rest of the state. I don't think people look at it that way anymore.
Well, you remember when Chep Morrison tried to be elected governor, many thought he would be successful, but he was not. He lost to a guy from Columbia, John J.
Yep.
McKithen, 50 years ago, when Susie Terrell was a tyke. Back in 90 seconds with Susie Terrell. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 5 days before the election, 297-5633. If you'd like to join us in our remaining moments with Susie Terrell and Steve Myers, local realtor, is on deck. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Commissioner Susie Terrell.
Yes, Ms. Terrell, do you think that had George Bush not started the war in Iraq and then pranced on the deck of an aircraft carrier in front of a mission accomplished, son, you might have beaten Landrieu?
I'm sorry, if he
not? At that time, the war had not started, by the way. It was still in the works. It started...
I think that she was very good at, in the primary, she talked about how much she supported President Bush. And then a runoff, she turned her support of... She turned President Bush against me, which was an interesting... But it works. She uses the sugar and some other things. She can get you off kilter. But one thing, Jim, that you said that always gets me on my soapbox, and we'll have to talk about this another time, is that as Republicans, we have not done a good job of getting women in office. in a state that is more than 50% women. We don't have one Republican woman in Congress or in statewide office or on the Public Service Commission, or, you know, and the last Republican woman that won statewide was me in 1999, you know? It's a long time.
Yeah,
and I'm surprised in this Senate race that Mary hasn't played to women more, you know, from that angle, that if she's not there, there is no, not saying that women will vote just because she's a woman, but on those kind of undecided, squishy voters who, you know, I always call it the 4%, the people that really decide the election, you know, the people who are trying to make a decision. There are some people that might, you know, that could have an effect on. And you don't have to be, you know, Betty Friedan to believe that we need to increase the number of women, you know, in public office in Louisiana.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, good morning. You're on the air with Susie Terrell.
Good morning, Jim and Susie. Great to hear you again. I wondered if you could comment on the fact that President Clinton has been in for Senator Landrieu and Hillary this weekend, but no President Obama here.
Well, I've been getting about every day around lunchtime, these polls come from this national, Ron Fauché, who started out in New Orleans also, and it's a summary of national polls. And Obama's numbers are so bad, and people dislike him so much, but I'm just not talking personally. His every policy is at 40%, 38%, 42%. Most Democratic candidates are running away from the president because he is radioactive. I understand, I don't know if this is true, I've been told that he's going to start campaigning for governors because the governors have to implement the policies of Obamacare. And there are several governor's races going on. But,
he was in Wisconsin the other day, and his poll numbers are not that great there, so you're right. But
he was there because that's still a hotly contested race, and if he can rally the troops, I think the Clintons are very popular. That's why I said if I, you know, I would have the Clintons here, not the president, but the Clintons are very popular, and Hillary is going to run, you know, and you could have another Clinton Bush presidential fight.
We could. But the men behind the curtain in this race are the president and the governor. And Mary Landrieu does not want to be seen with the president because he's unpopular in Louisiana. And I would imagine Bill Cassidy will avoid Governor Jindal because he's not particularly popular. They're running about the same in Louisiana based on poll numbers. Final call for Susie Terrell, Larry at Cortana. Larry, you're on with Commissioner Terrell.
Good morning, gentlemen and or lady. Look, Ms. Terrell, I'm concerned about why are we running so hard against the president rather than to tell me what you have on your agenda. The doctor will not say what he's really going to do.
All right. He does seem to be running against the president.
You need to go on and this is my personal Facebook page. I don't have a political one, but I listed the other night, I said somebody ought to really ask these candidates, what are the top three issues that face Louisiana? What are the top three issues that face this country? What do you think the job of a U.S. senator is? And whose leadership do you admire, as long as it's not someone in your own family? Because I had to say that because, you know, Mitch is mayor of New Orleans. But I agree. I think that we need to know what they stand for. You know, both candidates are, you know, they're running against Obama and Obamacare, and then Mary's running really against, she's running herself up,
you know, what she's done for the state, and then she's running against the 2%, which is where she's trying to put Cassidy. But in all, in this entire race, they're not talking about the issues that face Louisiana, but I will tell you, a lot of that gets driven, a lot of it gets driven by what questions you're asked in these debates, and I'm just talking from experience, because I remember all I wanted to, not all I wanted to talk about, but it was really important to me about the idea of, ours was right after 9/11, right after 9/11, and I wanted to talk about what would happen if somebody blew up the levees in New Orleans. And, you know, and I couldn't get anybody in a debate or on the press who wanted to pick that up. And what, you know, 3 years later, bam, we didn't blow them up, but the same thing happened. And that was a real issue when it came to terrorism. But we didn't talk about that. Mm-hmm. We, you know, our whole race became personal, and it became our main issue in our race ended up being abortion and personal attacks. And sometimes candidates don't have as much control over that as you think. I mean, if I ever run for office again, I'm going to have day-to-day control over what goes on TV about me.
Well, thank you, Susie, and we'll call on you again in the runoff. Take care.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure always. Joining us now, Baton Rouge realtor, lawyer, and a person who owns a lot of property in this town, Steve Myers. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Jim.
And Steve's been doing his homework over the last few days based on a story that has erupted after Congressman Bill Cassidy took aim at Senator Landrieu's $2 million estate in Washington, D.C. Cassidy, the congressman, has a home that's probably worth about $1 million in Baton Rouge, which means it might be worth three or four in Washington, D.C., but it's in Baton Rouge at 3115 Dalrymple. And like many properties in this city and across the state, I'm told, is assessed far below its actual value at $317,000. Is this anything unusual, Steve Myers?
I don't think so, Jim. If you remember when I actually ran for mayor 2 years ago, one of the first things I said to solve the money problem for the city was to actually look at the assessment system that we had, where in a lot of the old areas of town especially, you can look at these properties and invariably you find that they're 25-30% below what it seems like they would be based on the constitutional provision in Article 7, Section 18, that residential property should be assessed at 10% of the market value. So in the case of Representative Cassidy, when Mark Ballard wrote that story about the housing about a week or so ago in The Advocate, I mean, I read the whole story, and the thing that hit me like a ton of bricks was Cassidy's house on the LSU Lake being assessed at $250,000 or valued by Zillow at $254,000. Zillow's another story because it's invariably, notoriously inaccurate. But so I said I'd go to the source and went to the assessor's website and the sheriff's website to look at his tax bills. And sure enough, a lot on the LSU Lake, if you multiply the assessed value by 10, the lot that's on a hill nicely next to the lake, $28,000. The improvements, the building on the house is $289,000. So you put those two together, and
$317,000.
I have a rule of thumb that says you can tell whether a house is assessed at 10% of the market value by multiplying the assessed value by 10. In this case, you would have $317,000. And put it on the market, and how long would it take to sell? In this case, I think you would have about 50 to 100 offers within 48 hours for a $317,000 remodeled house on the LSU Lake.
So it's valued way below what it should be.
I looked at some of the other properties right there on Dalrymple, much mm-hmm. less. There's one across the street that's valued at $845,000. There's another one down the block at $835,000, another one at $800,000. There's a couple of them at $475,000. I mean, we're talking about now these are sales. These are what people actually paid back in 2002 or 2000, almost 10 or 12 years ago. So those are probably well over $1 million now, despite the dip in 2008. Mm-hmm. in 2010. And again, it's kind of a weird predicament because everybody's in this. It's probably the biggest silent conspiracy in town because nobody's going to walk down there and say, hey, Mr. Assessor, raise my taxes. Nobody can run for assessor and say, what I'm going to do is raise your taxes. But my contention is we wouldn't need a new millage or a new tax for maybe a decade if all of the money that's left on the table from these low assessments in South Downs, in the Garden District, in places where I'm buying a house in about a month, right in the Westdale area, right off of College Drive. You know what the lady's paying in tax for right now? $49. You know what I'm going to pay when I buy the house? $2,800.
For the same house?
For the same house. No improvements, no anything different.
Well, this is something I'm sure a lot of people don't want to draw attention to, Steve, but there's no doubt that this is going on, and it's just like the segregated neighborhoods. That doesn't happen by design. It happens because the neighborhoods are segregated. That does happen by design. They're segregated because the establishment, you're part of it, wants certain neighborhoods to stay black and certain neighborhoods to stay white. And what's going on around the state? When you provided me with this information, I said, look at the Landrews. Are they getting the same benefit that Bill Cassidy is?
Well, I'm not nearly as familiar with Orleans Parish, but I did go look at the house that Mary has, and it's valued at basically at $297,000 on
Prior Street.
On Prior Street in South Broadmoor. And I just out of curiosity, since Mitch was so good on your show, I said, I wonder what his is. He's got a house on Octavia on Ursuline area with a value of $550,000. But what's hard to really know is what's going on around there. And look, it's a complicated job the assessor has. They don't have enough resources to actually send an appraiser every 4 years as the Constitution requires. So what they have to do is come up with these algorithms and various formulas and other things. My contention is we need to spend a little money and focus a little bit with the technology that exists today to try to equalize some of these things. It's unfair that my house on Morning Glory has a $3,000 or $4,000 tax bill and a house that's worth much more, $3,000 tax bill assessed at $200,000 or $300,000, where another neighborhood vigilante that is worried about three people living together in a rental property.
You're talking about Paul Nocky?
Yeah, well, I
bet you've looked him up.
Well,
what's
of course,
his
house
at?
In 2009 when the suit was filed was assessed at $70,000 on Morning Glory. You couldn't buy a blade of grass for that amount of money. So I guess the point, now it's been adjusted since then, but that's the point. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of cases. That being said, believe it or not, the residential, the amount of money that the residential property tax brings into the city is really kind of minimal. It kind of sticks with it at maybe 15% of the budget. The reality is the people, if they ever looked at the commercial, the industrial, that's where you wonder what's the... Those are very hard to evaluate. So this is probably the biggest political predicament there is, because who could run for assessor or say, I'm going to raise your taxes, because everybody would rather keep their taxes $300 low. And
how about keeping the tax base the same amount and adjusting it on a fair basis? That way some people would see reductions in their property
well,
tax.
Well, in theory, that's what the Constitution says that should happen in Section 23, Article 7, the subsequent adjustments. If you remember, these taxing authorities that have to make a decision, if you have more property added to the tax rolls and you have increased assessments, right, it's supposed to be sort of a zero net, as
All
I
right.
understand.
Lavelle and Hammond, we'll try to get to a couple callers. We're short on time, but Lavelle, you're on with Steve
Myers. Yes, I'll be quick, Mr. Hengstra. I appreciate your comment just now about some neighborhoods in Baton Rouge are designed to stay white, some are designed to stay black. But in New Orleans, and I'm from New Orleans, live in Hammond, it is the greatest gentrification project in the country that is happening in New Orleans, and it's really happening to the detriment of the cultural fabric of the city. One of the local television stations did a really good story, a good series on gentrification, but it's much deeper than that. And yes, New Orleans is changing, and yes, maybe it is going to vote for a certain candidate more overwhelmingly, but what's happening in New Orleans is really scary.
All right, Steve Myers, native of New Orleans. I mean,
Catholics kind of all stick together, and it's Catholic Church, and they don't like the Baptists. Well, I mean, you could find all kinds of reasons that people separate themselves. We started this based on Cassidy's. I guess the point I'd say is that the article that Mark wrote was what's kind of spurred this. But as far as the Senate race, that's absurd that this is even an issue. That's a good example of the misinformation and distraction.
Okay, we got to go. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.